Drones for fresh human blood. A new social network, minus the mansplaining, how Zuckerberg claims he's going to fix Facebook, and a review of the new HTC Vive Pro. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 26, recorded Thursday, April 5th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase.
And by LastPass, join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Today Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. That was a close one. We've done it before, but it's okay because today is today. Mm-hmm. It also happens to be this week. Mm-hmm. Did we confuse you yet?
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Shall we get to the news?
Yes.
Okay, it's time again to check in with Evan Ackerman, robot expert from IEEE Spectrum, to find out what automaton is stealing our jobs this week. Welcome back, Evan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So a few years ago, a company called Zipline started using drones to deliver blood in Africa. And this week they announced they'd be heading to the United States. What can you tell us about these blood drones, as I've taken to calling them?
Yeah, these are literally drones full of fresh human blood flying over the skies of Africa. So these are delivery drones. I'm sure you're familiar with delivery drones from folks like Amazon and Google. But this company called Zipline wanted to do something like more useful. So they set themselves up in Rwanda. And what they're doing is they're taking over the blood supply infrastructure of the country. And they're doing that by using drones to take blood from a central kind of distribution point out to rural hospitals. And the reason this is so important in Rwanda especially is that there isn't a lot of infrastructure there. Like, the roads aren't great. And sometimes when the weather's bad, like, you know, vehicles can't get around. So sometimes these drones are the only way to get blood from one place to another.
And so what system do we currently use in the United States to get blood where it needs to go?
We do it the old-fashioned way. We do it with, like, vans. And our model is kind of typical for the way most countries deal with blood, is that you kind of get a bunch of it and, you know, the hospital has to have a bunch, and each hospital has enough blood to cover, like, anything that might go wrong. And the problem with that is that a lot of that blood just doesn't get used because you need to have more than you think you might be able to use, right? So that's really, really wastful. And what Zipline realized is that if you keep all the blood in one place and just deliver it exactly how much you need, exactly where it's needed, you can cut down that waste by an enormous amount.
From an infrastructure standpoint, when you're talking about, you know, this having been in places like Rwanda for the past year and now coming to the U.S., what are the different, with some of the different kind of aspects of the infrastructure or even the regulation here that might not be the case there, some of those challenges that they face?
Yeah, regulation is a big problem. And the FAA is just about to kind of announce, like, pilot programs. And the nice thing about starting in Rwanda was that Zipline could, like, it's a small enough country that Zipline could get, like, really friendly with the government and make sure that everything works and work with air traffic control there. And of course, the United States is way more complicated. But Zipline now can say to the FAA, and they've done this, like, look, we got this working in Rwanda. Here's how everything works. Here's how safe it's been. And you can just adopt this model and let us try it in the U.S. So probably by the end of the year, they're going to have some pilot studies running, delivering blood to rural areas that may have difficulty getting it otherwise.
So if you're just listening, you probably haven't seen video of this. They're not the quadcopter looking drones. They're pretty large. Nope. Can you describe, they were just newly designed. Can you describe the drones a little bit?
Yeah, they're like little tiny airplanes. They're fixed wing. They launch, they don't have any landing gear or anything. They launch from a catapult. They can carry about 5 pounds worth of blood or other medication and fly for hours through any kind of weather, day or night. And so they load the blood in, that launches off a catapult, it flies over to a rural hospital, and then it drops the blood out of itself, and the blood like parachutes to the ground with this cute little parachute. And then the plane turns around and comes back for landing, and it lands kind of like an aircraft carrier, where it's got a hook on it and it catches a cable. And then they can swap in a new battery and put in a new blood pack, and it can just kind of keep on going.
One thing I found interesting from the article on IEEE.org was about how this has cut down on medical waste, at least in the case of Rwanda. How exactly is that? Is that because instead of in transport, maybe the blood doesn't get there in time and it's wasted, it can't be used, but in this case, it's all making the way there, or is it a different kind of aspect that is saving on that waste?
Well, a lot of it is that blood has a shelf life. And for some blood products, that shelf life is like only 5 or 6 days. And if you're in a hospital or a medical clinic and you're doing things the old-fashioned way, you have to say, look, I need enough of this stuff that if something really bad happens, you know, I have enough on hand to cover any emergency. And just what ends up happening is that since you have to have that much with you all the time, if you don't use it, it just goes bad.
Right.
But if you have it in a central location and you can deliver it on demand, then hospitals only need like exactly how much they need for, you know, the next half hour, because if they need more, the drones can just bring it.
Hmm. So why a drone then in the United States? Why not a manned plane?
Well, a drone is easy to get, or easier anyway, to get kind of from one point, one very specific point, to another very specific point. And the disadvantage is that, you know, a manned plane or a van can carry a lot more blood, but drones have the potential to be much faster, and where they lack capacity, you can just send a whole bunch more of them. So in Rwanda, for example, they've had cases where there have been women who gave birth in a rural medical clinic, and they needed, like, something went wrong, and they needed lots and lots of blood, and they just, like, sent drone after drone. They sent, like, 10, 20 drones just dropping their little parachutes full of blood, and it worked.
Well, moving on to another robot story that you wrote, roboticists from the University of Washington in Seattle recently looked at 157 different robot faces across 76 dimensions to determine what people want in an expressive robot. A very important study. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so they're looking at these social robots, which are robots that are designed to, like, interact with you in your home or maybe in a commercial space. I don't know if you've seen any of these, but they're getting to be more and more of them. So they looked at 157 different ones, and they looked at their faces, and these are all digital faces. So they're faces on screens, which means that they're really cheap and easy to make. So we're going to see a lot more of these things, but it also means that you can be creative in all kinds of different ways about how you actually, like, draw and animate the face. So they looked at all of these to see, like, what kinds of faces are good for some things and what kinds of faces are good for other things, and, like, what design choices are people making and how do consumers react to the way that different robots look.
Yeah, I think it's funny that Jibo, which I mean, we've all, I mean, especially here at Twit, you know, our network, the fans of the network definitely are familiar with the Jibo. It's kind of, you know, pegged as being this family friendly robot. But the thing about the Jibo is it doesn't actually have a face. It just has a big dot in the center of this big circle. And based on this study, I mean, it was seen as the unfriendliest robot of the bunch. It was seen as untrustworthy, if I remember correctly, or obviously didn't tick all the boxes. Apparently, you absolutely need to put a face on your robot if you want people to like it.
Yeah, poor Jibo. Although we should say that the researchers looked at static faces, and Jibo does a pretty good job of animating that little ball.
Sure.
But a lot of people... You know, not everybody has a positive reaction to Jibo, so there's some truth there for sure.
Yeah.
Well, the study also said that the less friendly faces were the ones lacking a mouth, lacking pupils, and possessing eyelids. So why are we afraid of robot eyelids is my question for you.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but the people thought that these robot faces with eyelids looked kind of sly or smug. And it's interesting, they also thought that they looked a lot more masculine. And it's, the friendliest robots had perfectly round eyes, which like are not what human eyes normally look like. And most of the robots like chose to stay away from kind of human like oval eyes. So it's really interesting how like people react to that completely differently. But if you want to make a robot that's like for security or to have like some like measure of authority or sinisterness, then the eyelids might be a good idea. But for a home robot, maybe go with the circular eyes that everyone seems to like more.
And did they like the feminine ones better? Was that an issue?
Some of them did. There was some of the study was looking at like what aspects people associate with masculine and feminine. And I think the feminine ones tended to have eyebrows and like kind of blush marks on their cheeks a little bit. But the more humanoid or human looking features you add, the robot, whether it's going in the masculine or feminine direction, tends to start to get creepier. So people like the simple, you know, simple expressive robots, but don't get carried away.
And if they're female, they need to be wearing makeup, is what you're saying.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, back in February, you reported that NASA sent a humanoid robot to space, but it's been broken up there for years. What can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, this was Robonaut. And Robonaut is this big, beefy kind of humanoid torso. It's totally cool looking. And you can see the picture. It's a really awesome robot. It's designed to do like everything that a human can do, at least the upper half of a human. And NASA sent it up there in 2011. The idea was that astronauts are really smart and they're really expensive to have up on the ISS, but they spend a lot of their time just doing chores like inventory and cleaning stuff. So NASA thought, well, why don't we build this humanoid robot? And we'll control it from the ground, and it can do all of those chores so the astronauts can keep doing science. So they built this thing, and it was totally like a science project. And they built it, and then NASA was like, oh, hey, do you want to send this up to the space station? And they were like, okay, sure. So they sent it up, and it worked pretty well for a while, and it did some useful stuff. And then NASA was like, okay, this is going great. So how about we put some legs on it? So they were like, well, we didn't really design it to be upgraded, but okay, we can try this. So they sent up the legs. Robonaut had to be completely like disemboweled. The astronauts spent 40 hours replacing its computers, which were never designed to be replaced. This robot was not supposed to be taken apart. So they tried to swap all this stuff in, and then after they did, the robot kind of stopped working. And this was, I think, 2013 or 2014, and they have literally been troubleshooting it since then, kind of on and off for the last 3 or 4 years. And they eventually figured out that it was a like power system problem. They'd been sending stuff back to Earth and bringing it back up to the space station and swapping things around, but they can't fix it up there. So they've decided, okay, we're just going to bring it back home. I think in June it's scheduled to come down. And they're going to fix it and send it back up again, and hopefully it'll be good to go.
Maybe they'll include a face when they send it back.
They should.
Maybe a little more friendly.
They should read that paper about whether to put eyelids on it or not.
Yeah. And I think the lesson we learned here is never disembowel a robot in space.
Totally.
And finally, whenever we talk about self-driving cars, I know a lot of our viewers from the colder climates worry about how they will work in the snow. They kind of make fun of us Californians. Oh, well, that couldn't work in the snow. But you linked to a video from a company called Torque Robotics that shows a self-driving car navigating in a snowstorm just fine. How are they doing this?
Well, snow is a problem for driving, right? It's a problem for humans. It's a problem for robots. And it makes things hard to see, like in the air when you're looking just straight ahead of you. And it also makes things hard to see on the ground. So robots have trouble with both of those things too, but actually maybe not as much trouble as you might think. So just snow in the air that makes it difficult to see. Robots, like you can see on the car, it's got this spinning thing on top of it. That's its LiDAR sensor. It's shooting lasers out. And it uses that to detect objects. And sometimes those laser beams run into snowflakes, and that's kind of a problem, but we're actually pretty good at filtering out when it sees a snowflake and when it sees something else. And cameras also have trouble in the snow, but the car also has radar on it to help with that. So kind of everything gets, all the sensors get fused together, and that makes the car a lot more capable in some ways than humans are, since we only have our vision. Mm-hmm. And then there's the issue of snow on the ground, which makes things slippery and also makes it difficult to like see lines on the road and stuff and know what lane you're in. So for the slipperiness, that's not really a problem for the cars. Like they're better than almost any human at driving in snow, because they have all these sensors and they like know what's going on with all their wheels all at the same time, and they have a lot of practice at this. So that's not something to worry about. And then being able to tell like where lines are is not so much a problem, because like the way that autonomous cars know where they are in the world is by looking at all the stuff around them. And they have really detailed maps of everywhere that they drive. So they know exactly where all the lines are, because they've driven all these routes before and they have the maps. And as long as they can see enough stuff around them, like if they can identify buildings or stop signs or telephone poles or anything, they can kind of match that to the map that they already have. And then they know where everything is. They know where all the lines are and everything. So they don't even need to see them. They just need to know where they are in the world. And they're pretty good at doing that.
I think the big thing to get over will be the fear, just because it's so, right. I mean, the only
trust.
Thing, yeah, the
yeah.
only thing that keeps me calm driving in the snow is if I'm the one driving. I think, well, I can always take control, but
right.
yeah.
Yeah, but then you have all these other people around you.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Half of them could be crazy and mm-hmm. terrible drivers, and that scares me. I'm kind of hoping that, you know, when the robots are doing all the driving, the one human on the road who refuses to get a robot car is going to be the most dangerous person.
That's true. Well, Evan, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Evan Ackerman is a senior writer for the IEEE Spectrum's robotic blog. He is constantly posting there everything robot you can imagine. You can follow his work, unless you want to be unprepared for the robot apocalypse. So if you don't care and you're afraid, you know, you're not afraid of them taking over, then don't read his work. But if you want to get ahead of the robot,
you probably want to.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Thanks so much, Evan.
Thank you, guys.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
So online communities, they can be inspiring. They can also be toxic, exhausting. We've all experienced that, particularly when they're left uncontrolled. Working moms have often turned to communities on sites like Facebook to share their stories and ultimately find support from others who happen to be in their shoes as well. But even that can turn ugly. Joining us to talk about the new community platform for working mothers called Chairman Mom is Sarah Lacey, also author of The Uterus is a Feature, Not a Bug, and founder of this site. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's fantastic to get you on. Really stoked to have you here. So tell us a little bit about this. It's right now, in this particular moment of time, there's tons of change in the air. It feels like the right time, pretty appropriate anyways, to launch a site like Chairman Mom. How long have you been working on this vision? I imagine part of this kind of came from the creation, from the work that you did on your book. Kind of what was that process like initially?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's interesting. The sort of famous Idea Lab founder, Bill Gross, did a study where he looked at 300 or so startups and what were the factors that made them the most successful or the most likely to fail. And he found that timing, more than team, more than idea, more than execution, was the single biggest factor. And we have like the world's best timing. So if Chairman Mom fails, I'm happy for people to just say I was a crappy entrepreneur, because like I would have to extremely, extremely just fuck this opportunity up. So, you know, I guess where this like really gestated was when I was like had my first child gestating in my stomach. Like a lot of women in America, particularly in Generation X, I was just fed a ton of lies about motherhood. I was told pretty much from, you know, my adolescence on that the second I became a mother, everything that I had worked for my entire life would become meaningless, and that I would become distracted, and that I would essentially like become disabled. In fact, when you go on maternity leave, it is classified in this country as disability leave. And that's for people lucky enough to get maternity leave, which only 15% of the population gets any paid maternity leave. And, you know, I was struck by the disconnect when I became a mother, and what happened to me professionally, and everything everything I'd been told. And I just kind of had these moments where I kept being like, it was all lies. It was all lies. And I was so much better at everything. I mean, my net worth escalated. My ability to write was better. My ability to creative problem solve was better. My stamina was more pronounced. My productivity was way better. I was a more empathetic manager, which, you know, means I was a better manager. Every single, my whole world was in more focus. Like the things that really mattered to me became really clear. And, you know, a lot of women get talked out of their voice. A lot of women get talked out of their ambition and, you know, what they believe and their place in the world. And for me, becoming a mother was like, once you have this child who you love more than anything and you're their female role model, like you take that so seriously and you don't compromise in ways that you totally would have compromised if it were just you. And it's also like, you know, I got a lot of notoriety for this like 4-year battle that I basically did with Uber when I was running Pando. And it's like people give me props for like all of this courage and in that fight. But like when you have your child who you love more than anything look at you and tell you they hate you when you're trying to punish them or teach them a lesson and you stand firm, like some stupid bro is like not going to intimidate you or shake you off your game. Like I just felt like I had superpowers. And so that was what prompted me to rewrite the book, because I felt like that was a message that I certainly didn't hear as a young woman. And women I were talking to weren't hearing that message, even though I found all this data to support up that like I was not an outlier in that. And, you know, I was really, you know, during this process of building Pando and becoming a mother and experiencing all this, I also got divorced and became a single mother. And I really resented this idea that had been put forth, you know, in the previous decade, that the answer was finding some enlightened spouse who would let you have a career. And it was just like, that's just another way of opting into the patriarchy. And, you know, and so all of that drove the book. And over the course of writing and reporting the book and connecting with so many women, I was like, this is such a bigger thing. And I had all these side projects around this topic that were just engulfing and taking over my life because they were so needed. And so, you know, a year ago, I finally got the confidence to, you know, raise money and start this as a real company. And, I felt like it was an amazing opportunity. And it was one of the last wide open opportunities on the consumer web. I mean, there are very few addressable audience that equal half the population of the world that no one has built a $1 billion web company for. And there's one reason, and it's bias. All consumer web companies are built out of founders' experiences. Less than 3% of venture-backed companies have female CEOs. I don't know the figure on how many of those are working moms, but I think with the age bias that we also have in this industry, I would imagine it's pretty low. So, you know, I had access to money and I had access to developer talent, and I had already been through the ringer once building Pando and, you know, also having helped build TechCrunch. And I knew this company needed to be built. And if it wasn't me building it, I was going to be pissed. So I decided I was going to jump in and do it. And that was a year ago. And I thought at the time, you know, there's this great quote that I recently heard Katarina from Flickr say on Reid Hoffman's awesome podcast, that great startups like get out in front of already amassing crowds and parades. And I felt like we were already doing that with this intergenerational women's movement. And what I couldn't have known is that in the last year of building the company and putting together the team and raising the money, that we would actually, by the time we were ready to launch, wind out in front of two parades. We're not only in front of the parade of the women's movement, we're out in front of the parade of the toxicity of ad models. We always conceived of this as a company that would be subscription-based for so many reasons. We spent a long time studying why so many mom communities had become so toxic and why those communities go sideways over the history of the web. So this was something we kind of were experts on well before Cambridge Analytica, well before all of the people who got rich on Facebook were talking about how toxic it was and how they wouldn't let their loved ones use it. So we've kind of found ourselves in front of two parades, which is, you know, why I'm happy to take the blame if I screwed this company up, because it could not be better positioned.
So I was a big fan of Pando. I listened to your podcast, which is the same name of your book, and you interview amazing female founders of companies, and it's great to listen to. So I immediately signed up. I paid my $5. Well, I didn't pay my $5 yet because the first week is free. I put in the credit card. And it's Fantastic. I entered a question and apparently it didn't come up right away. You just choose certain questions. So my question hasn't gotten chosen yet. But then I just got an email because I followed a bunch of questions I was interested in. I got an email and the answers to the questions were delivered to me. I spend a lot of time on the internet. I subscribe to a lot of sites and there's nothing like this, nothing quite like this model where it's not just a newsletter, but you're delivering me the specific answers to the questions I chose to follow. There were some about like baby gear. You know, my kids are 14 and 12. I don't need that anymore. You know, I don't care about that. But the ones that I was interested in came to me. I love the model. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, thank you so much. That's such an amazing compliment because I know you do see so many things and we did try to build something distinct and that's so hard to do at this point in the internet. You know, our whole model just start to finish was like, let's rethink what community is because there's things that we take for granted with web communities that were built for young white men who had endless time and didn't have, you know, and didn't have to worry about getting bullied and didn't have a lot of the things that we deal with. I mean, I think every woman or person of color or disabled person, you know, or immigrant probably knows that if there had been more diversity in the room when Twitter was being created, we would have a different product today. And so we wanted to rethink the assumptions that we think were kind of faulty assumptions that were born out of not having diversity. So everything, one of those core things we thought about was working moms are really pressed for time and we want to add value to them. And this like beauty of being a subscriber model is, you know, we don't have to addict you. We don't have to give you dopamine rushes. We don't have to do all these creepy things that other social networks have had to do in order to create the, you know, the views, the addiction, the constant coming back to the site in order to sell, package you up and sell you. All we have to do is create $5 a month of value for you. And when you think of it in terms of value versus every other metric that we've been trained and conditioned to optimize for, you know, you think of it totally differently. You get to a point where you're like, we're going to pick two questions a day and that's it. And we'll send them out to you in our newsletter. And if you don't have anything to add to those two questions, you have better things to do with your day as a working mom. We don't need to manipulate you into coming to our site. And we want the moms who have those questions. I mean, as you probably saw, the questions that we select are really focused on the hardest problems that working moms face and working women face. I mean, they're not all explicitly about parenting. And, you know, we want those people to get attention. You know, we want our community of like superhero badasses to like focus on those handful of questions for that day. And, you know, so we want to make everything as efficient as possible. And that means that, you know, you shouldn't be having to keep the window open and refreshing when you want to see new answers on just that question. In the future, one of the things that we want to do is have it so that you can answer by text or email. I mean, you don't even have to log in or open up our page. If you're standing in line at a Starbucks and you see a question about egg freezing and you're like, holy shit, I have the answer to this and I have to tell this person this right now because it's going to save them so much heartache and misery and I have 2 seconds. Like you should be able to just type that into a text or an email and send it and then that gets posted on your behalf. Like we just look at this as how can we give you this sense of connection and fight this isolation and make you feel like you've got this and you're doing something badass for your family and you and you're helping other women. And how do we give that to you in like 5 minutes a day in the most efficient way possible? Down to the tiniest feature sets, it's a really dramatic way to rethink how you build community.
I'm sure in testing the site and kind of preparing for the launch that happened officially yesterday, it kind of went public yesterday, there were, you know, moments in testing where women were interacting with the site and you learned a little something about it that maybe you didn't expect. Are there any, some of those lessons that you learned about how women are using the site or some of the things that maybe they're communicating about that you didn't quite expect?
Yeah, so there are two things that were really interesting. The first is we try to pick one question about work and one question about life every day, and we get way more life questions. I would have expected we would get way more work questions because I feel like whenever I go to things or I speak at things, people ask me about how to raise money or how to network or how to find a mentor or even about you know, reporting sexual harassment. But we've gotten way more life questions. I mean, things about people's marriages, things about infidelity, things, you know, a lot of threads about how to raise sons. I feel like there's so much talk about how to raise daughters, you know, these good feminist daughters, and we don't talk about how to raise feminist men. A lot of questions about teenagers. You know, a lot of the mom sites are really focused on babies. And, you know, that was stunning to me. But when I sat back and thought about it, it made sense. I mean, high-powered working women have probably found a way to advocate for themselves in some way or focus and survive in a work setting. But I think that, you know, the thing they probably ignore the most is their life, you know, their relationships, their desire to have love, their desire to have fulfillment. So, I mean, that was sort of shocking, but fascinating. And in the future, we may have to revisit having one work and one life question because, you know, the life questions really get so much engagement and that seems to be where a lot of the need is. I think the other thing that was really interesting was just the reality of what happens when you do anonymity the way that we do. I have not historically been a big fan of anonymity online. I mean, Panda was very instrumental in bringing down Secret. You know, we thought it was an incredibly toxic environment. But the beauty of Chairman Mom is because it's a subscription model, first of all, you just don't have a lot of trolls because, like, you can abuse women at scale, not paying $5 a month, a lot of places. Like, you have to, it's just not where you're going to go to troll people. But, you know, beyond that, you have to, you will enter your real name and credit card when you sign up. And so we know you have some sense of identity connected to the site. But then on a sort of message by message, answer by answer, question by question basis, you can choose to go completely anonymous. And by completely anonymous, I mean, we mean really anonymous. Like, we do not know who you are. Literally, I've asked or answered questions and my CTO doesn't know it's me and vice versa. Like, we have no way of tracking you. And what's interesting about that, like, it sounds great when you're thinking through this problem and we're not going to, we don't need to track people or repackage them because we're not an ad business. So we can give people that much radical anonymity. The issue is we can't send you notifications. So one of the things that we immediately wanted to do was when someone answers your question, you get a notification. We can't do that when you go anonymous because we have picked radical anonymity over every other feature we might want to roll out. And I think some things like that are kind of hard for our audience to wrap their head around. Because no one believes that you can go as anonymous on the web as we allow you to go. So I think in the future, we may actually have to come up with like some middle ground where it's like, you don't want your name displayed, but you don't quite need the security of if we're ever hacked, no one would ever know it was you. Like, maybe you would rather have some of those features like notifications, or later on down the line, we have a lot of features we're going to roll out that will be like deeper interactions between people, you know, small groups being formed around, you know, really interesting topics that are impacting a dozen or so women. And, you know, we can't bring you into that if you were radically anonymous. So maybe there may actually need to be a third group beyond just anonymity and not maybe what we classically think of as internet anonymity. It's been fascinating to really test some of the assumptions of what people think even words like anonymous mean online and how that ripples through the product design.
Sure.
So I assume that you allow men to be a part of the community as well, which is fine.
Why don't you just roll your eyes at me? I'm so uncomfortable right now.
But do you encourage men to be part of the community just to sort of see and like have some more empathy for what working women and you know, working mothers go through?
I have not yet made up my mind if it's something I encourage or not. We had this is probably one of the biggest debates that we had in the company was whether or not to allow men to be part of it. And frankly, I think the only one who was really on board with that. And the biggest reason I was twofold. First of all, I just think rigid gender identity is increasingly a relic of the past. Mm-hmm. And I'm just as a human being that's, you know, trying to build a site that's inclusive and welcoming as possible and undoing a lot of the damage of, you know, the last 15 years of the consumer internet. I just don't want to put out anything that artificially makes someone feel devalued. And you know, one of my children is very gender fluid. And I think, you know, every parent knows when you've seen your child wrestle with something, like, you become a warrior for that cause. And, you know, a lot of places deal with this by saying, if you identify with a woman, that as a woman, that's good enough for us. But there's a lot of people who don't identify either way. And I just thought that rigidity, I wasn't comfortable with. But I think, you know, beyond that, there's a lot of, you know, gay dads that are both dads. So what do? Neither of them wrestles with work-life balance issues. Neither one of them is the primary caregiver. Neither one of, like, it just seemed crazy to think this is a biological woman only problem. And so that was the main reason that I pushed to not have any rigidity. I definitely love female only spaces. So, I mean, I don't, that may wind up being a huge mistake. I'm still not totally sure. But, you know, in the meantime, I think it's great if men want to really understand what women are going through and really want, you know, and especially if men have these outdated ideas of women are catty or women are so mean to each other, or like, oh, the mommy wars are just inevitable because women are so judgmental. Like, come look at this site, because we've had like 700 answers to questions. They're really hard questions that would be super divisive elsewhere on social media. Most of the answers are longer than 500 words. And we have never had to pull a single answer so far. No one has flagged an answer. None of them are abusive. None of them are judgmental. So, you know, I think it's a great place for men to witness the strength and love and compassion of women, and how this moment in time, how much women really want something different than the internet has given them and want to support each other. But, you know, I hope we don't get like those threads you see on other question and answer sites where men just come in and start mansplaining things, because I don't know what we're going to do. Like, it may wind up being a big mistake. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, I can understand the challenge there entirely. But I do, from a man's perspective, I think that it's awesome to have the opportunity to gain that perspective, right? Even from just a viewing the discussions happening and maybe not participating, it's important for men to understand that these challenges do exist, not get in there and do the mansplaining, as you say, and really just kind of understand that we all have our challenges and our perspectives that reside outside of our own personal perspective, and that that's an important thing for everyone to understand. And I love what you're doing with Chairman Mom. I'm going to tell my wife about it, by the way. Beta.chairmanmom.com. Is that where people should go if they're interested in signing up and getting started?
Yeah, I think also just chairmanmom.com will take you there now. And yeah, we'll give you 7 days free. It's, you know, about the price of a cup of coffee. And if you're in San Francisco and you decide that's been a horrific waste of your money for a month, I will buy you a cup of coffee somewhere to make up for it. I think for our ability to not package or resell you, and every single line of code we write is for you, everything we do is for you, I think it's well worth $5 a month. And, you know, if you go to the site and you don't think it is, come back again in a month or so, because we're building new features every day. And, you know, we want to earn your trust, and we want to earn that $5.
Right on. ChairmanMom.com. Sarah Lacey, it's a pleasure getting you on the show. Thank you so much for taking time. Now get to your daughter's birthday party.
Thanks. Celebration. Work-life balance in motion.
Thanks, Sarah. Take care, Sarah. We'll talk to you soon.
I didn't mean that about...
I know.
We have many conversations about being a working parent. We have a lot of the similar, sure. and share our job in a very healthy way, I think.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I was just joking. After the break, why didn't Facebook come forward about our scraped data sooner? And is the new HTC Vive Pro worth your money? But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Building your online brand has never been more important. Your online identity begins with your domain name. If, let's say, in the past you've promoted yourself or your business, or even just posted photos to share with family and friends on Facebook, and now you're like, I don't want to be on Facebook anymore. Maybe you're planning to leave Facebook. You're gonna need to get yourself a great domain name, and it's not too late. Your domain name tells the online community who you are and what you're passionate about. I already own MeganMaroney.com, but maybe I want MeganMaroney.mom or MeganMaroney.soy. or meganmaroney.republican. I can get all those if I want. Web hosts and websites evolve as their brand, website, and hosting needs change. Keeping your domain separate from hosting gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. No one wants to be stuck with a solution that doesn't meet their needs. The best in class, Hover offers it. They offer customer support team and no upsells. Hover Connect allows you to connect your domain name to many website builders with a few simple clicks. It is not difficult. Personalized email that matches your domain further supports your online identity. Free Whois privacy. Hover also has over 400 domain extensions to choose from, including all the basics and those fun niche extensions that I mentioned earlier. Go to hover.com/twit. Go there now and get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/twit. And we thank Hover for their support.
So there's a whole laundry list of news involving Facebook this week. All of it, obviously, reaction to the fallout of the Cambridge Analytica revelations from a few weeks ago. And now many more big changes are coming to the Facebook platform. Joining us to discuss these changes, to kind of help determine if it's all enough, is Josh Constein from TechCrunch. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. It's been a while. So yesterday really seemed to be a big kind of coordinated day of announcements, beginning with a post by Facebook. Facebook was detailing changes to its many APIs and Facebook login itself. What would you say are some of the most impactful and interesting changes that were announced yesterday that might actually, in a very large way, change how we think of Facebook?
Sure. So Facebook shut down a ton of the APIs that app developers use to be able to build applications for people. So there's a lot of private information that app developers are just not going to be able to pull from people anymore. Facebook really restricted that and pulled it back. The Instagram API is also no longer working, the old one. So anybody who built apps or used apps that let you analyze your followers or your audience or figure out who doesn't follow you back, that's all gone now as well. But I think the most interesting thing that we learned yesterday was that Facebook has shut off its search by email and phone number tool, which was really useful if you were in a country where a lot of people have the same name or it's hard to type in your keyboard, or just if you wanted to quickly find someone because you had their phone number but you weren't sure of the spelling of their name. But it turns out that scammers were using that tool to scrape people's public information off of Facebook. They'd basically punch in your email address, and then they'd get your name and your photograph back, and they'd be able to use that to build these profiles of you for other email targeting and other stuff. So that's really problematic. So Facebook shut off the search tool entirely. So that's going to make things a little bit harder to find friends for some people, but it's definitely going to help make sure that no more people get their information scraped. Unfortunately, Mark Zuckerberg admitted that pretty much everyone who allows themselves to be searched by these tools, which is on by default, probably already had their information scraped.
Oh, that's no good.
So you posted the audio from the call with Zuckerberg, and it was fascinating to listen to. One of the things he said was that that Facebook was an idealistic and optimistic company, and they spent the first decade in existence focusing on the good. But their whole business model is based on profiling us in order to sell advertising. So has anything really changed besides the fact that they've gotten caught doing this?
No, I mean, Facebook's business model is not going to change. You know, that is really the way that they make money. And I've in the past suggested that Facebook could offer richer users in the West a subscription model where they could pay instead of being targeted with advertisements. But overall, I think Facebook isn't going to change its business model, but it's certainly changing the way that it deals with privacy. I've criticized the company in the past because it's really, like you said, one of dreamers. They're people who anticipate the best of humanity, but have a really tough time thinking about what are the worst ways that somebody could abuse their platforms. And I think Facebook is finally waking up to the fact that humanity just isn't as nice and kind as we might have liked. And so now it's really drawing back a lot of its privacy options and making sure that people can't be exploited in the same way that Cambridge Analytica did.
Hmm. Yeah, and find this part interesting. You know, it was a couple of days ago that we were hearing, or at least there were rumors that Facebook, you know, was going to keep Europe's general data protection regulation safeguards, you know, and keep them firmly in Europe. But then, of course, Zuckerberg admitted that he has plans. Facebook has plans to implement that around the world. What do we have any sense as far as like what that looks like? Is it going to be the same type of implementation? Will it be tweaked for the world? And what can we expect from that?
So Facebook is going to basically follow the spirit of GDPR, these new European privacy regulations. So that means giving you options to have your information deleted or allow you to download it. It's going to be giving you more data and information about exactly how it collects data from you. So that means everything from like your battery level to the nearby Wi-Fi nodes or cell phone towers. Facebook did a big terms of service rewrite yesterday, actually, where it explains all of these things in a lot more detail. And so basically, Zuckerberg said that Facebook is going to be offering a lot of the same protections that you get from GDPR, but because they're actually laws, GDPR is a law, it's not necessarily compliant with other laws around the world. Sometimes they contrast or contradict each other. And so Facebook isn't going to be able to have the exact same implementation or interface for some of these tools, but Facebook does really commit to doing a lot of what GDPR offers. And I think that that's really great for users.
I'm less concerned with the fact that Facebook has a profile of me, like a psychological profile, and, you know, can try to sell me things based on the fact that I'm neurotic or anxious or whatever, all the things I am that it already knows. I'm more concerned about democracy and elections. And I know Zuckerberg said something, he said some things about protecting the midterm elections and possibly elections all over the world. What can you tell us about the changes that he made in that area?
So since Facebook's big failure during the 2016 election to prevent fake news and election interference from Russian trolls, Facebook has built a bunch of new artificial intelligence systems that it can use to seek out and kill these accounts, these fake accounts, these trolls, and these election interferers. And it's already started testing those in elections in Italy, in France, in Mexico, and it actually tried them in the United States during the Alabama special election and found them to be quite successful in finding these rings of illegal accounts and shutting them down. And so we do have hope that things are going to go better in terms of election interference on Facebook during the 2018 midterm elections. That said, you know, spammers are always thinking up new ways to abuse these platforms. It's, as Mark Zuckerberg said, a never-ending battle. You know, anything with security is an arms race, and you're constantly just jockeying for position. So expect those spammers to come out with new tactics to screw with these elections, and Facebook to have to constantly try to keep up.
Were you at all surprised at, during the call, Zuckerberg's call, at kind of his atonement, his tone throughout? I mean, there were many times that he admitted, you know, and it said in no uncertain terms, like, it was my mistake. It falls on me. I know some people have been talking about, well, what does a Facebook without Zuckerberg possibly look like? But, you know, realizing he's like the largest shareholder in the company. So it's probably not going to happen unless he decides to make it happen. But could those lines come around and bite him in the butt somewhere down the line, possibly with what we have, you know, him going ahead of Congress here on April 11th?
No, you know, I think he was really trying to give a rallying call to Facebook. Well, you know, users might be a little bit pissed. That delete Facebook hashtag movement actually peaked way lower than delete Uber because there's really no alternatives for right. Facebook. Meanwhile, regulation is probably not going to actually hurt Facebook that much unless the government goes so far as to separate Instagram and WhatsApp from Facebook. Instead, that kind of regulation could actually just amount to paperwork and a speed bump for Facebook, but while actually deterring possible rivals or competitors from being able to start up and get to the point where they could be real competitors to Facebook. But the biggest problem from all of these scandals has been internal morale. If people wake up every day who work at Facebook and say, I'm building a weapon, I'm not building a tool for humanity, I'm building something that hurts society, they're not going to keep working there. And long term, that could lead to a stagnation of innovation for Facebook. So what I think Zuckerberg was trying to do yesterday was get out there and have a moment of humility, a moment of contrition, where he said, yeah, this was my fault. I screwed up. Yes, Facebook as a whole is responsible, but I'm the one who runs this company. It's on me. And we're going to make a serious show of moving forward and making progress. We're done dismissing the problems as crazy or trying to downplay the extent of them. It's done just apologizing, and it's finally ready to get to work. And I think these sweeping changes on its developer platform really show how serious it is, because Facebook wouldn't piss off developers by breaking all their apps if it wasn't sure that this was the only path forward for the long-term health of the social network.
He also said that they were going to hire 15,000 new people for security and review. Do we have any idea what these people might be doing, whether they're like going to be Facebook employees or contractors? Do you have any idea on what these jobs will look like?
Yeah, so these are people in both security and content moderation. And so at the start of the year, Facebook had 10,000 people in these jobs. It's now moved up to 15,000 and has promised to move to 20,000 by the end of the year. That's showing that it's really willing to spend money to fix these problems. And yeah, what these people are working on are both the kind of engineering back-end election interference protections that include building these AI systems that hunt down trolls or building other systems that detect and prevent scraping or other abuses of Facebook data. But they're also content moderators who are going to be individually reviewing political ads or flagged content to make sure that dangerous stuff, violence, propaganda, truly fake news and hoaxes don't end up spreading around the platform.
Yeah. Well, the snowball just keeps rolling down that hill, and we'll certainly be following it as it does. Josh Constein with TechCrunch, really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to join us today. Thank you for your patience today, Josh. Appreciate it.
Oh, you know I like you guys.
Right on, Josh. We'll talk to you soon, and best of luck. All right, up next, Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica is going to join us. It's good to have Sam back. He has some thoughts on HTC's newest Vive Pro VR headset. But before that, let's take a break and thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is LastPass. LastPass keeps your passwords organized and secure and right at your fingertips. I've been using it for quite a while now. We use it here at Twit. We're big fans. There are too many passwords to remember, whether it's managing your personal accounts or securing your workplace credentials. LastPass makes password security effortless. You just remember, all you have to do is remember your master password and make that a good master password, and LastPass will remember the rest. If you're reusing the same password over and over on all sorts of sites, well, LastPass can actually generate and store strong, unique passwords for all those sites for you to keep you safe and secure. And it makes it super easy to do that on all of the sites that you have passwords saved on. LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or even on a mobile device. It integrates with the apps on your device on iOS and Android. You can explore your LastPass vault, dive in there and find sites that way. You can easily add, view, and manage items that you've saved. LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools that you need to secure your business while centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. And did you know that over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords? We've all seen those lists after a breach happens where they show you the passwords that were stolen, and you just shake your head and you wonder why somebody would use password as their password. Well, LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. They make it super easy. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. Sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to protect from man-in-the-middle attacks. And yeah, I remember when I first started using LastPass, I wasn't even quite sure how many login IDs I had, how many sites I had to track. And once you start to realize that and really use LastPass and let that vault build up with all of your passwords, you understand why passwords can be so difficult without something like this. So LastPass is a great solution to keep you secure and protected online. And LastPass has other products, by the way, besides Enterprise for Business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for the entire family, and LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you.
The HTC Vive Pro launched this week as a $799 upgrade or $1,099 brand new. Joining us to talk about what he thinks of the new pricey virtual reality headset is Sam Moscovich.
Come back to us, Sam.
Technica.
Hold on. I'm almost to the final boss.
Oh, hey there. You've reached the final boss.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the highest compliment I can pay my good friends at twit.tv. Hello, everybody.
Hi, how you doing?
I've got the Vive Pro, which you can see in my terribly lit office, slightly bluer than the HTC Vive. That's not exactly the only thing you're paying $800 more for. What would you guys like to know about this very expensive device?
Well, I would like to know what you're paying $800 more for.
Sure. The basic, most primary thing is what you can't really see in the video, which is the upgraded resolution on the eyeball, the panels on the inside. These have grown almost 80% to a resolution of 1440 by 1600 pixels per eye. That is compared to 1080 times 1200 per eye from the prior Vive. So yeah, about 80% difference there. And what that really does mean when you are inside of a virtual reality app is a removal of the screen door effect, meaning when you're looking at kind of a distant giant virtual world, you don't see these sort of pixely stair steps the way that you otherwise would inside of the Oculus Rift or HTC Vive. Both of those headsets, which are 2 years old now at this point, have that older resolution amount and that kind of stair steppiness. So that is the basic amount. Now, remember that $800 just for the headset. You can't really use a Vive without a pair of wand controllers and a pair of tracking boxes. You need to pay an extra $300 if you're not upgrading from the original. So the actual starting price for this bad boy is $1,100.
Wow. Okay. And that's primarily the biggest advantage, aside from some of the ergonomic changes that they made. It looks a little bit more solid and sturdy, is this higher resolution. It's always been, and I'm curious to know your take on this, it's always been my opinion that resolution is actually way more important to the growth of VR than I think a lot of people give credit for. People are just like, resolution, whatever, it'll look better, but you know, there are other things to consider. I feel like higher resolution matches reality, and that in turn makes for a more immersive experience. So this seems like the highest resolution consumer VR system available right now, right? Would you say that it makes a really big difference?
I would say it makes enough of a difference that I have really enjoyed it. Now, okay. I have been testing these headsets really for 3 years since the sort of initial preview push began in earnest in 2015. And there are sets that you can pay a lot more for, proprietary and weird ones. $5,000 is the amount that I was quoted for one that I tested with 8K resolution. It made me look like some sort of creature out of a bad Blade Runner spinoff. But yeah, this is right at now at the $1,100 mark. This is as good as it kind of gets. And I would say, yeah, the difference that's really crucial for me is when a game is running at full cylinder and you have more resolution, you just feel that more comfortable and that more immersed in the proposition that you're suspending disbelief. I think the best example for me was the Doom VFR game, which came out late last year from Bethesda and id Software. This was a reimagining of the 2016 Doom reboot. And it made me wonder why we need another Doom. And it felt kind of fun, but also a little bit sickening because there's a lot of quick movement in it. On the Vive Pro, that extra bit of pixelation, or depixelation, I guess is the word, really did make enough of a difference for me to feel like a superhero, to feel like I was in this world, I was in control, I could move fast, I could see everything coming at me, both close up and really far away. We don't have computers that are cheap enough to run even higher resolutions than this. I'm already running a pretty expensive PC just to get this one running smoothly. So this right now is sort of the sweet spot. But the price does make me think that they're not trying to get this into average consumers' hands.
Who are they trying to get to buy this? That's my big question.
Yeah, I think that's VR arcades and sort of industrial houses, design firms, architecture firms. I think HTC is saying something really important here that's getting lost in some of the reviews and buzz, which is that they are not placing a bet on average Joes buying an HTC Vive. HTC seems to really want to have its reputation and its financial future on this idea that VR is going to be limited, that it is going to be this weird slash premium product, and that you have to go into it both spending money and investing sort of personal energy in understanding how VR works, being willing to put up with cords and expensive computers and all that stuff. That's very different than Oculus, which has Mark Zuckerberg shouting about getting a billion people into VR. HTC's not going to get a billion people in VR with something like this that doesn't feel like a giant, giant jump. It feels incremental. It feels nice. It doesn't feel like, oh my God, this is the ultimate next wave level of VR. So it's an interesting decision on their part. Microsoft did similar things with the HoloLens a few years ago when they priced theirs starting at $3,000. That was them essentially saying, yeah, we're limiting this on purpose. We have intent.
Interesting. And then you actually have in there, I'm not sure if this is it, but you have a side-by-side shot with the Oculus that makes the Vive Pro look positively gargantuan in comparison. And from the top shot, what you're not seeing in this shot is kind of like the rear of the head fastener versus kind of like the fabric that you see on some of the other ones. What about comfort? Like when you're wearing this, is it as heavy as it looks, or is it a light, nice feel, balanced, that sort of thing?
It's funny because I thought it was lighter. When I put it on, I felt comfortable. The way that the back clasp moves down lower, I can show you real quick. Sorry if this blurs the camera. It's got a really nice 90% angle lock. You can just pull it up. This, by the way, is a really great way to get glasses wearers into the Vive. It's got this really nice push-pull on the inside for getting glasses. But when you get this whole thing on, this thing lowers down more than more than the original HTC Vive. And so we thought, oh yeah, it's lighter. Then we got a scale out. It's about 50 grams more than the original Vive with that Vive extra audio strap added, which they came out with last year for an extra $150 or $100. Either way, it was too expensive. So it's really good at redistributing all that weight. And I think that's really interesting. It is over-engineered, I would say. Oculus really nailed their simple fabric design from the get-go. Really, no one's beaten that in terms of simplicity. Although we think the PlayStation VR is actually ultimately better at taking the weight and having the glasses sort of situate over your head in a hovering state. We still think that's sort of the best on the low-end side of things. This is definitely over-engineered, but I could see someone at a VR arcade, for example, being able to clamp it very securely, feeling like the weight is distributed, and being able to move around a bunch. And I know that VR arcades want to deliver that, especially in regions outside of the United States. China loves VR arcades.
So real quick, before we let you go, PUBG, which I've been introduced to lately, I'm not making it up. It's a real thing. And now it's on iOS. Leo was playing it on iOS today, earlier this week. It was fascinating. You say that they have now filed a lawsuit against some people that are creating similar PUBGs.
Megan, welcome to 2017. It's so good to have you here. Yes, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, a.k.a. PUBG, is huge among the youths, as you may have learned. It's getting only bigger because it came out on smartphones, as did its biggest rival, Fortnite Battle Royale. They're both very similar in terms of these 100 players on the same battlefield, dropping in on parachutes, battling to be the last person standing, all that stuff. And there was actually rumblings last winter about PUBG not being happy about Fortnite, but no legal action was taken. And we were kind of wondering when legal action would happen. Well, it did, but PUBG went after a Chinese game publisher. I'm blanking on the name. NetEase is the name of this company. They have games called Rules of Survival and Knives Out. They're both quite similar to PUBG. They look very similar. And PUBG filed a suit in California federal court asserting that 25 specific traits of PUBG have been copied. It's a very interesting and unique case because you don't see this happen very much in video games. This sort of thing came and went in the 80s a little bit with companies saying that each other were copying each other's arcade-y style stuff. And ultimately, big publishers backed away from suing little guys because they didn't want to set a bad precedent. If it turned out, oh, that lawsuit about a really Pac-Man-like game didn't pan out, and then all of a sudden everybody's making a Pac-Man clone because judges said it was okay. But PUBG's going full on to say that this Chinese game maker went too far in copying all of these different little elements about PUBG. They even go so far as to say the game's use of winner, winner, chicken dinner as a celebratory phrase, which PUBG has no dibs on, is part of the lawsuit. The fact that these other games use the same phrase, use little like rubber chickens and chicken references, is pushing on PUBG. That's going to be real weird if this does indeed go to trial, as opposed to just a big bravado chest-puffing settlement. So we're definitely, in terms of gaming and law, keep a huge eye on this one. This story is only going to get more interesting.
I actually made up that winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Well, good for you. Everyone owes you a Coke.
We've got them in the fridge, so I'll give it to you.
I have to say, I think Knives Out is a better name than PUBG.
Well, PUBG is a terrible name. That only got popularized by Twitch people shortening it and shouting it. They called themselves PUBG Corp primarily because gamers sort of went with that term. And that they had millions of people at that point. So although there's also an argument that Plunkbat which is a shortening of Player Unknown's Battlegrounds, is the better way of shouting it. If you ever go to Ars Technica's comments section, there's always that guy. We see you, man. We're not going to respond, but we see you.
Okay, I have another question. This one's a little bit sensitive. But when Leo was playing PUBG on his iPad, he had to play for a long time in his underwear. Is that normal?
Yes.
Okay.
There is a movement of players who believe it is quieter to play in no clothes. You can customize your clothes. In fact, there's a whole loot box system. Don't get me started on that.
No,
about the different clothing you can
boxes.
Get. And so there are folks who it's the nude society of PUBG.
Okay. Huh. Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
I'm
for
glad that was. I like that. That's sensitive. Like for me, like that's nothing.
Yeah, I know. Well,
a whole new world.
Sam, thank you as always for joining us. I still think that there's a podcast in our future where you explain video games to me. So
okay,
keep that
yeah,
in mind.
But first up, I have to go back. I have to go back to the better world, the one that's not this one.
Okay.
So I'll see you guys elsewhere.
Thank you. Sometimes you can find Sam on Twitter, Sam Red, and you can find him at Ars Technica, of course.
Thank you, Sam. We'll talk to you soon if we can ever get you back out of that VR space. All right. Finally, because apparently we're doing more of this. You guys are sending us selfies. And Aunt Pruitt did not want to be, you know, miss the party. He says, this is me listening, watching TNW while I edit a photo. This is the only time TNW isn't viewed on my larger monitor or on my telly. Sorry, Photoshop and Lightroom takes priority. Mm-hmm. I understand. I
feel like I'm kind of giving you the stink eye over your shoulder, or like looking over your shoulder there, Anne. So thank you. Thank you. I will imagine that. And here's a follow-up from one of our selfies from last week. Ben writes, here's me listening to TNW on the flight back to Indianapolis and hearing the hosts doubt whether or not I'm truly listening to Tech News Weekly. Because you remember he was,
yeah.
And we... I think you doubt. I don't.
Yeah,
know
I think I doubted a little bit on that.
So he's listening.
I didn't doubt. I questioned.
Yeah.
You could be listening to anything. But that frown, I think, convinced me.
Mm-hmm.
Frown was very convincing.
It was a good frown.
And finally, Phil sent us this selfie taken while he was listening to TNW while rolling up I-65 between Indianapolis and Chicago in my Freightliner. CB handle is Electric Rooster, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Phil, for keeping your eyes on the road. I appreciate that.
Thank you. And thanks for sending those in.
Yeah.
TNW at twit.tv if you want to get on the selfie train. We won't stop you. In fact, we might put it in the show like we've been doing.
But I encourage you to send
them. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv, like I said.
Mm-hmm. And subscribe to our show. That you can do that at twit.tv/TNW. However you listen to your podcasts, we are there and we're for you. Audio, video, watch on your TV, use a Roku. Just watch and subscribe and tweet at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell if you want to tweet at me. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Josh, Jammer B, Colleen. I'm sure there were other people in here helping out. Alex was here earlier helping out. You were there, and you were there, and you were there watching and listening, and we appreciate you as well. We'll see y'all next week. I will anyways. Megan's on vacation on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody. Who am I going to high five when you're not here?